Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 7th of January. First hour of our program today, Kathleen Hunter will be joining us, reporter for Congressional Quarterly. Of course, the first day of the 111th session of Congress started yesterday, and we'll be looking at the many issues before Congress. The president-elect has said that he would like an economic stimulus package on his desk by January 20th. We'll talk about that. There is news today that Roland Burris from Illinois will be seated. Does that look like it is a strong possibility? And what do you think of that? We'll also be talking about Al Franken and what it would take for him to be seated. And if that could go on for a long period of time, the legal challenge. So some have said he wouldn't be seated for months. We'll look also at the Democratic majority and what the makeup is of this Congress in the House and in the Senate. Is it more conservative on social issues, as some have suggested on the House side? And how will the Republicans govern? Will everybody get together to deal with economic issues and other important issues before the country? Lots to talk about this hour. Your phone calls are very welcome for Kathleen Hunter. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that as well by going to talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Kathleen Hunter, who likes to be called Kate, is with us the first hour, reporter for Congressional Quarterly, who's been very busy the last few weeks writing about the issues before this new session of Congress. Kate, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, nice to have you on the air. There is some news today that Roland Burris will be seated. This has been back and forth and back and forth. What do you think about this? Will he be seated? Is there any reason for him, legitimate reason for him not to be? And do you see a change on the part of the leadership of the Democratic Party to say, okay, let's let him in?
Well, I think what we were starting to see yesterday was a number of senators, when Mr. Burris came up to Capitol Hill, who started to raise some questions, Democratic senators, who started to raise some questions about the legitimacy of not seating Mr. Burris. Dianne Feinstein, in particular, came out and expressed concerns about the precedent that it might set. Illinois is not, by any stretch, the only state that allows gubernatorial appointments when there's a Senate vacancy. So I think that there was some concern that if Democratic leaders were even appearing to stand in the way of a gubernatorial appointee, that could set a really bad precedent. So I think we're starting to see a bit of a sentiment moving in the direction of eventually seating Roland Burris to that seat.
What about the idea, Kate, that it has to be certified by the Secretary of State of Illinois, who hasn't done that?
Well, that's really the primary issue right now, is or at least as Democrats, as Majority Leader Reid has cast it, is this question of the certification that goes to the Secretary of the Senate requires two signatures, one from the governor and one from the Secretary of State. Mr. Burris currently only has one signature. That's from Governor Blagojevich. The Secretary of State has refused to sign the certification document. So yesterday when Mr. Burris came up to the Hill, the Secretary of the Senate said that his credentials were not complete and therefore he could not be certified and he could not be sworn in. The question of how we get past this problem, whether Democrats back away from the requirement of having the two signatures or whether the Secretary of State changes his mind and changes their mind and decides to sign the form, that's I guess, an open question. We'll have to see how that plays out. But that seems to be the hang-up at the moment.
What about Al Franken? Coleman has said he's going to legally challenge this. I've read that it could be months before somebody is seated from Minnesota.
Well, and I think the Burris case and the Franken case, while separate, are connected politically in some sense, in that the Democrats really would like to seat Franken because that would be a pickup for them. That would expand their the number of seats that they picked up this past election cycle to 8 from 7 where it stands now. And so the question of, you know, now that Senator Coleman has said that he'll contest the canvassing board's decision to give the election to Mr. Franken, it raises this question of how long are Democrats willing to wait to let this play out?
What's the answer to that? How long do you think they are?
Well, a senior Democratic aide told me on Monday that it was not out of the question that they would seat Al Franken this week, that there would at least be an attempt by Democrats to seat Al Franken this week. It's Wednesday now, and we haven't seen that, so maybe it will get pushed into next week. I would be surprised, frankly, mm-hmm. if it was this week. But I just think it's very telling that Democratic leadership was looking in that direction as of Monday, even before the canvassing board had issued its verdict.
And how do they decide? Do they vote on whether or not they're going to seat somebody? How does it take place?
Well, when they go to the floor, and yesterday they had the swearing-in ceremony for all but the Illinois and Minnesota seats. So there were 34 senators that were sworn in yesterday, and they go to the floor and they have a swearing-in ceremony. But it's my understanding that there's a point at which, and I think everyone is consulting their rule books and talking with the parliamentarians right. to figure out exactly how this would work. But I believe that there's a point at which the credentials are presented to the secretary, and the secretary then presents the credentials. And it's my understanding that it's a little fuzzy, but that at some point in that process, someone could make an objection, presumably a Republican could make an objection that could force a vote on the issue. But again, that's still a little fuzzy as to how exactly that would work.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything in print that says you must fill these seats by such a time for the Senate to be operative?
Well, really, it's up to the Senate has, the Constitution says that both the Senate and the House have ultimate discretion over when and how to seat their members, or whether to seat a particular member. It's very interesting, when I started looking into this, in the past, there are a couple of recent examples of senators that were in close elections or elections that were still being contested. The most recent is Mary Landrieu, the Democratic senator from Louisiana. When she was first elected, her Republican opponent, contested the results of the election. And at the time, the majority and minority leader got together and decided to give her what's called a provisional seating, where to seat her, it's called without prejudice, and it's sort of a provisional seating, a seating designation, where she's sworn in as a senator, and she has normal floor privileges, and she gets committee assignments, but the issue is referred to the Rules Committee, and the Rules Committee reviews it and basically retains the right to go back and basically withdraw her seating, or they make a recommendation to the full floor, which will then can act on the issue.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like if there is an attempt to seat either Coleman or Burris, it would likely be something along those lines, where they would get a provisional seating, where they'd become essentially a senator, but the Rules Committee would look into the issue to make sure that there weren't any kinds of irregularities and would retain the authority to go back and recommend that their provisional seating is withdrawn.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it amazing, Kate, that a seat can be determined by something like 250 votes, if that holds true? Goodness.
It is amazing. It's such a slim margin, and it's a very, very slim margin. It's a slimmer margin than the Landrieu case, for sure, and than a lot of the cases that come up in recent history.
Yeah. We had heard in the last few days that it looked like it was going to be Caroline Kennedy from New York, and now today we're hearing, maybe it's going to be Cuomo. What are you hearing?
You know, it's so funny because everyone has gotten so, really the attention here on the Hill has been very focused over the last 2 days on Burris and Coleman, or Burris and the Minnesota seat. And both the New York seat has kind of fallen by the wayside, whereas that was all the talk in December, was a lot of speculation about who would be taking Senator Clinton's seat when she steps aside to become Secretary of State. And most of the New York lawmakers on the Hill are being very tight-lipped about the whole thing. And so I guess we'll just have to see when it comes out. I've been mostly on the Hill up in New York. They might be hearing different things in Albany, but on the Hill, everyone's been very tight-lipped and, frankly, pretty preoccupied lately.
Yeah, I would imagine. There's a lot to talk about. The president-elect has said that he wants an economic stimulus bill on his desk by the time, and this is only a week from Tuesday, when he is sworn in. Is everybody working busily on this, and is there any possibility that there will be such a bill on his desk by that time?
I think the chances of there being a bill on President-elect Obama's desk as soon as he takes office are pretty slim. I'd say they're slimmer than they were this time, a week or two ago. Obama and Vice President-elect Biden and incoming Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel came up to the Hill on Monday and met with congressional leadership from both parties. And coming out of that meeting, there seemed to be a sentiment that Democrats didn't seem to want to appear to be moving too quickly on the stimulus. They wanted to move quickly, but Republicans seemed to feel that a January 20th deadline was a very short time frame and might not give them a chance to put their stamp on the legislation. So I think Democrats, sensing that, are maybe backing away a little bit from the January 20th deadline and saying, you know, leaving the possibility open that President's Day recess in February would be a more realistic time frame. And I think that that's interesting because I think as a political posture, they're trying to keep Republicans from throwing up a lot of roadblocks to the stimulus.
Mm-hmm. I would think that this is one issue that the American public is almost demanding both parties to do something and do it quickly. And they're not going to be the American people are not going to be very happy if this is delayed.
Well, and I certainly don't get the sense that members of Congress in both chambers, that the congressional leadership isn't going to try to start working on the stimulus straight out of the gate. We will probably see the beginnings of legislative business. Yesterday was mostly pomp and circumstance, swearing in. We'll see the beginnings of legislative roadmaps and legislative business today in both chambers. And I would be surprised if stimulus wasn't right at the top of the agenda. That's what everyone's saying. And so I think they'll definitely start work on it, but I just don't know. I think there was a sense among Republicans that trying to finish everything up by a week from Tuesday might be too hasty.
Right.
And so I think that we'll start hearing rhetoric from both sides of the aisle about how doing it right is more important than doing it quickly.
Are you still hearing complaints, or has everything changed in a matter of a couple days about the appointment of Leon Panetta?
You know, we're still hearing a lot of complaints about that. I know that both Senator Feinstein, who's the incoming chairwoman of the Intelligence Committee, and Senator Bond from Missouri, the ranking Republican, both had a lot of concerns about about Panetta's lack of intelligence experience, and so experience in the intelligence community. So I think that that's a concern. Everyone has remarked at how much positive response President-elect Obama's designates to his cabinet, his appointees have gotten so far. So I think this is kind of his first real pick that was met with, I think, a lot of surprise and also some serious concerns from both sides of the aisle.
Mm-hmm. Does it indicate a dramatic change from the previous administration when it comes to issues like detainment, Guantanamo, torture, et cetera?
Yes, it definitely does. And I think that that's I think that is where people are, Democrats at least, are saying that they're not necessarily opposed to the pick, some Democrats at least, but I think there is a concern that on the experience angle, or the experience aspect, and I think that there's definitely senators on both sides of the aisle that during the confirmation process would need to be reassured.
Mm-hmm. Is he a pretty well-liked man in Washington? Is he deeply respected?
That's my general sense, is that he's, you know, Senator Bond said yesterday that he's, you know, worked with him in the past and that he has, you know, a good working relationship with him, but he can't necessarily get past the experience question, and he's going to have to feel reassured during the confirmation process.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Kate, and we'll take them in just one moment. Kate Hunter is our guest, reporter for Congressional Quarterly, the 111th session of Congress. Members were sworn in with pomp and circumstance, as she said yesterday, and today they are busy at work on all kinds of issues. So join us with your thoughts. We've talked about Roland Burris and Al Franken and Caroline Kennedy. We also are talking about the issues that you would like to see Congress move on today, if not sooner. Would you like to see an economic stimulus package by January 20th? Will you hold Congress responsible for dealing with this issue very, very soon before things get much worse? We're hearing news about a huge deficit. And what do you think about the makeup of the new Congress? What do you expect from them? That's the big question of the hour. Join us with your phone calls and then, of course, Kate can just tell you listen to your concerns and write about them, right? She has been covering all of these issues for quite some time. It's a busy period of time for her. Here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Like to send an email, you can do that at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Our lines are open for you right now. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Your phone calls for Kate are welcome. Our number is 800-486-8655. Next hour of the program, Jonathan Alter wrote an interesting piece in the January 12 issue of Newsweek. Don't muffle the call to service. And it calls for a push for national service that the president-elect Obama has a moment that he needs to act on. He's gathered so many volunteers that now is the time to ask them to do something significant for their country. So we'll talk about that the second hour. And we go to phone calls now for Kate, starting with Jim from Galesburg, Illinois. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been listening to the radio for the last hour and a half, and I just had to call on this one. I'm a registered Democrat at 72 years old and voted for Obama. And I hope that they seat the senators, both of them up there, that he's going to need the votes. And I hope they pass a stimulus package because this country definitely needs one. But I've got to tell you this, if the Democratic Party can screw anything up, they will. They've already started off with on the wrong foot, picking on the senator's pick or the governor's pick from Illinois. It's legal. They ought to seat him and get on with the business of passing some stimulus package for the people of this country.
Kate.
Well, you know, Jim, you raise an interesting point. You know, one of the things I think that Democrats are grappling with right now is the fact that they anticipated starting the year with 58 Democrats, and now they only have 57. And in the Senate, you need 60 votes to do pretty much anything. So the Democrats are starting because of this vacancy in Illinois that they assumed someone would be in place to fill by now. Now that this the arrest of Governor Blagojevich has kind of thrown a monkey wrench into those plans, and now they're having to figure out how to move forward on issues like the stimulus with one less Democrat than they anticipated having. Now, I think the point is valid that they would have an easy solution to that problem if they decided to seat Mr. Burris to that Senate seat, but that hasn't been their plan so far.
You don't find this problematic, the circumstances under which he's been named, Jim?
No, because if we judge the governor of Illinois by that standard, then we should have impeached Bush and Cheney 4 years ago. I mean, it's ridiculous. Legally, he's been appointed by a governor that hasn't been convicted of anything. He should be seated, and the Democrats ought to stop hitting themselves on the big toe with a hammer.
Yeah, what if he is convicted a month from now?
Well, it wouldn't make any difference. At that point in time, I think you deal with the issue at that time. But up until he is convicted, he has the power to appoint a senator or appoint somebody to that seat, as do many other governors. If we really put that, if you take that out to the total limit of what would happen if you had a Republican governor under scrutiny for some reason or other, and he appointed a senator, is that going to happen every time something like that happens? I don't think you want to get into that area.
Mm-hmm.
If Burris is clean and Burris doesn't have a problem, then they should seat him. You know what I'm saying? It's to me, it's simply the matter of law.
And do you like Burris? You're from Illinois. Have you been following him?
Well, I didn't vote for Burris when he ran down there. No, I'm not. I'm not a Burris fan. But in my opinion, which is just one poor voter, that once you start down this road, you open up Pandora's box for every governor and every state in all the states in this country. And I just don't think the Democratic Party ought to be that stupid to do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, it's ignorant. They need the vote. Put him in the Senate and go with it, and let the governor of Illinois handle his own problems. Or if he's convicted, he's convicted.
Kate, what do you think?
One of the interesting things is that here we're dealing with a situation where we're having the confluence of Illinois state law and federal practices here in the Senate. And I spoke with someone on the morning of Governor Blagojevich's arrest. I spoke with a lawyer at the Illinois State Board of Elections, and the lawyer that I spoke with told me that under Illinois law, that it was this was his top, off the top of his head assessment. You know, this would, could potentially have to be worked out in the courts. But that is off the top of his head assessment was that as long as Governor Blagojevich remained governor, he had the authority to appoint someone to fill a Senate vacancy. And so there is the argument or the point that Jim is making is definitely valid in the sense that, and this is the point I think also that Senator Feinstein was making yesterday, that it does potentially start down a slippery slope if you say, well, this governor, he's under scrutiny, so he appointed someone, but you know, we're not gonna seat that person because he's under scrutiny. And I think that that is therein lies the kind of the rub for Democratic leadership. So it's potentially problematic.
Right. Thank you, Jim.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye. Let's go to Scott from La Crosse next. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. Thank you again for another wonderful program.
Thank you,
Kathleen. My question has to do with the workings of the United States Senate, which every time I hear about it, it seems more and more arcane. Such as most recently, I heard that it's the first Senate. We still have our first Senate. That this thing has been ongoing ever since the inception, and it never actually adjourns, or it adjourns but doesn't have another session. I don't get it. But at any rate, what I wanted to find out from the guest is, I had heard that the Republicans had introduced this procedure where they could end run the filibusters by making bills part of financial money bills somehow. And I just wanted to know if the Democrats actually do not wind up with a filibuster-proof majority, is that something she thinks that they would be using in the next term? And just if you could just explain, you know, not to bore everybody to tears, but just a little bit how that actually works.
Well, Scott, you definitely hit the nail on the head when you described the Senate as arcane. There definitely is a lot of interesting procedural questions over here, and it's true that the Senate it's called a continuing body where they don't, unlike the House, they don't adjourn every 2 years and start a new. They adjourn, but they don't break sessions every 2 years and start a new session because senators serve staggered 6-year terms. And I think that what you might be talking about is there was a rules package over in the House that was approved yesterday that would make it more difficult for Republicans to offer something known as a motion to recommit, which is a way that Republicans in the minority have used that procedural tactic to stall legislation that Democrats have tried to move. So I think that might be what you're referring to.
Mm, yeah, I thought it was something that was specific. They don't filibuster in the House, right?
So right, that's
something that
Senate.
I thought was some end run around a filibuster, that something in the Senate, but as I say, it's hard for just somebody who's not, well, I mean, I guess that's why somebody like Robert Byrd has always been able to, as the guy who knows the rule book backwards and forwards, keep fooling everybody even in his own body. But, yeah, I don't know what that was, but it struck me it was some way around a filibuster, but I just don't know.
Yeah, I'm not aware of a current proposed change of that sort.
So here we'll go again, more gridlock, huh?
Exactly.
Cool. All right. Thanks,
Scott. Thanks very much for the call. Which brings you to the question of, from your look at the members of the House and from the members of the Senate, when we look at the Republicans, when we look at the Democrats, do you see any significant philosophical change in the makeup of the body? Are the Democrats more conservative? Are the Republicans more conservative as well? Is there a wave of liberalism here?
I think, generally speaking, in both the House and the Senate, we're seeing expanded Democratic majorities that are encompassing broader political spectrums. You know, the in the Senate, there are going to be more Democrats, and you have everyone from Mary Landrieu, who's a fairly moderate Democrat from a southern state, to Bernie Sanders, who is an independent that caucuses with the Democrats from Vermont, who is very, very liberal. So the same is true in the House. I think in the House, we're seeing within the Democratic caucus more of a moderation of the Democratic caucus. There's definitely been, in the past two campaign cycles, there have been a number of Democrats elected from districts that President Bush carried in the presidential race. And so those are generally considered to be more conservative districts. So we're sort of seeing a move to the middle on the part of the Democratic caucus in the House. And so that's something that's both leaders, Speaker Pelosi and Majority Leader Reid, are going to have to grapple with, in the sense that they'll have to keep their growing and unwieldy caucuses together. It's a good thing when you're the majority leader or leader of the majority party to have more members, but the problem you run into is that then it's harder to keep them all on the same page.
Mm-hmm. And what about the indications we're receiving from President-elect Barack Obama? I know it's pretty early to ask this question, but do you see indications that he plans to govern from the center?
Definitely. I mean, at least I think Republicans are everyone's favorite word up here seems to be, or favorite phrase seems to be, that they're cautiously optimistic about everything right now. They like to have there's lots of cautious optimism. And I think Republicans, especially when you speak to them, talk about being encouraged by President-elect Obama's rhetoric and talking about wanting to govern from the center. And I think the cautious part comes in where they say, okay, actions speak louder than words. Let's see what really happens. But I think that there is a willingness on both sides of the aisle to try to, as there usually is at the beginning of a new administration or a new Congress, to try to work in a bipartisan manner and to govern from the center. And I think there's a little bit of skepticism, though, still, that might actually be feasible. But I did think it was worth noting yesterday that Tom Coburn from Oklahoma, who's a very conservative Republican senator, he was on the Senate floor talking about his friend Barack Obama and how much he was looking forward to working with him. So Obama, in his short time in the Senate, has won friends on both sides of the aisle, and I think there is a very real sentiment, particularly here in the Senate, of wanting to work across the aisle with Obama.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and our guest on the Ideas Network this hour is Kate Hunter. She's a reporter for Congressional Quarterly, and we're talking about the 111th session of Congress, which was sworn in yesterday, and looking at the controversy over seating a couple members and what will be on their agenda right off the bat here, and what your thoughts are about all of these issues. 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you. Doug from Green Bay, our next caller. Hi, Doug.
Hi.
Hi.
A question I hear a lot in regard to the governor of Illinois is where does innocent until proven guilty stand in all of this? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Kate?
Well, I think that's where it goes to, as it pertains to Governor Blagojevich. I think that is, at least from the state-level perspective, the way the law is written, that the Illinois state law says that the governor, even if it doesn't explicitly say it, but it says until the governor is either removed from office or convicted of a felony or, a certain type of crime, that he retains all the powers of being a governor. And that would include the power to appoint a senator to fill a vacancy. So I think that at least at the state law level, the law is written in such a way that it would sort of mesh with the idea of innocent until proven guilty. However, I think that question goes to some of the concerns that have been raised up here by some of the senators who are concerned about the prospect of not seating Mr. Burris, I mean.
And thanks very much for the call. Can we talk a little bit about executive orders? Does the new president plan to fairly immediately change some of the executive orders? And if so, what might they be, the changes?
Well, at the top of the list is actually an executive order, President Bush's executive order about stem cells.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that there's been a lot of speculation that President-elect Obama, when he becomes president, would be one of his first orders of business would be to issue an executive order that would basically allow increased federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. Now, one of the interesting things is that there is also some question of whether that might be one of the bills that we could see move through the Congress in the next couple of weeks. And the question naturally arises of why would Congress do this, even if the president can come in and do it by executive order. But this is a piece of legislation that President Bush has vetoed multiple times. So I think there might be a sense that having Congress act on it and putting it in statute would make it last past any future president. So there might be an attempt to do that as well. But stem cells is really right at the top of the list of things that we would expect to see in terms of an executive order early in the Obama administration.
You've also written recently, Kate, that one order that dates to the Clinton early days in office is not likely to be changed immediately. The don't ask, don't tell policy regarding gays in the military.
Yes. And that's an interesting one because that's one that created some early administration consternation for for President Clinton when he was in office during that administration. So I think, in some sense, I think maybe Obama is kind of learning from, I don't want to say Clinton's mistakes, but the heartburn that the Clinton administration got over that issue. And it's worth noting, too, that there are a number of people that have already been tapped to be in Obama's inner circle that are former Clinton-era people, most notably Rahm Emanuel, who worked in the White House during the Clinton administration, remembers, was involved at a very high level in crafting policy in the Clinton White House in the early years. So Obama is coming in with some institutional knowledge about how things worked the last time there was a Democrat in the White House.
Mm-hmm. And also, before we go back to phone calls, whether to move quickly, you say a trickier question this is for Democrats with a top priority of labor union allies, legislation mm-hmm. easing union organizing rules.
Mm-hmm. And I think this has been an interesting question because we're kind of seeing a little bit of a behind-the-scenes tug-of-war on this issue. Democrats, one of their main constituencies is labor unions. Labor unions have been wanting this so-called card check legislation that would make it easier for unions to organize. They've been wanting this for some time now. During the campaign, if you talk to labor union officials, they would talk about this as their top priority. There was an effort to move it through the Senate last year, and that was unsuccessful. But I think there's a sense now that there's going to be a Democrat in the White House, and there's expanded majorities in both chambers. But the time has come for, at least in the mind of labor unions, for Democrats to take some action on this. However, Republicans are already bracing for fighting back against Democrats if there's an attempt to move this. And a number of people, aides on both sides of the aisle, have pointed to this issue as something that if Democrats did try to move this type of legislation early, that really could poison the well of bipartisanship.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Craig from Onalaska next. Hi, Craig.
Good morning. My comment is that the United States is supposed to be a country where each person gets one vote. And I feel that the U.S. Senate doesn't follow that tradition that we have of one person, one vote by having the filibuster. I think that it gives the filibuster gives the minority party too much say in what's going on. And I think a perfect example of this could be the stem cell thing if it goes through Congress. I think it's going to have to be done by executive order because the Republicans will filibuster it. Any other important piece of legislation can be easily blocked. So I'd like to see the filibuster rule be done away with.
There was an effort a few years ago, several years ago, to change the filibuster rules, and I think there's a real one of the things that is very interesting about the Senate. It's interesting about Congress as a whole, but particularly the Senate is very wedded to its traditions. And I think that one of the previous callers mentioned Robert Byrd, the president pro tempore of the Senate, and he's just one example of sort of the old guard that very closely holds to Senate traditions. And whereas the House is more of a fluid body in that the membership changes more often, it's a much bigger body. The Senate is more staid, and things just happen very, very slowly. Change comes very slowly to the Senate. So I would be surprised if there was any successful attempt to either weaken the filibuster rule or change the filibuster rule anytime soon. But I think that proponents of the idea of having a filibuster talk about the idea that that in the Senate, you know, it goes back to even in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, that there's a long tradition of senators being able to get up and debate things for hours and hours until they're ready to sit down. So that's definitely a long tradition here in the Senate.
Craig, what do you want Congress to work on right away?
The economy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that unless we get people back to work, get our financial house in order, get people to have credit so they can buy things that they need, this country is going to go down the tubes. And I can see ideologues on both sides. I consider myself an independent, so I'll vote for whatever party I think is going to do the best for America.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point in time, I think that there's too many people that want political advantage rather than doing something for the country. I spent 20 years in the military, so I feel that, you know, I did my part, and I think that people need to put the country first. I made a lot less money in the military than I could have in civilian life. And I think that we need to have people in Washington that put country first and profit and party second.
Thank you, Craig. I think a lot of people share your your beliefs here.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for the call. And the AP is reporting now that Senate Democrats do plan to accept Roland Burris for the Illinois Senate seat.
I saw that. And actually, it's interesting. I got a note from one of my colleagues saying that that Harry Reid's office is saying that that is not the case.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I don't know. You know, I've obviously been talking with you all, and so I don't know what the deal is. But it seems like there is still some uncertainty about that. But that certainly is what AP is reporting. And so usually, I mean, that's coming from somewhere. So
right. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, we shall see. There tends to be, you know, this back and forth of there's a report and then, you know, the Democratic leadership, if you know, may rebut that to a certain extent. So I don't know the details, but it
right.
seems like there may be at least a little more to the story at the very least.
Yeah, it will develop today. You'll be on it, Kate.
Exactly.
Right?
It'll be very interesting.
Yes, it will. We're going to welcome more phone calls in a moment. Our guest is a reporter for Congressional Quarterly. Kate Hunter is joining us, and she's written extensively about the 111th Congress. We're talking about that this hour and welcoming your phone calls. We have a couple lines open if you'd like to join us. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and we'll be again with you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program, we'll talk about national service and whether or not the president-elect should take this moment and call for a meaningful national service program for Americans. Kate Hunter, reporter for the Congressional Quarterly staff, is our guest now, 800-486-8655. And we go to Mary next from Sauk City. Hello, Mary.
Hello. First of all, as far as Burris, I really wholeheartedly believe unless there's a legitimate law not to seat him, they should seat him. But my other comment was, since President-elect Obama seems to be really well-liked pretty much on both sides of the aisle, isn't there possibly less chance that maybe there'll be filibuster? Maybe I'm just in denial, but I'm hoping that, you know, there will be some bipartisanship because the Republicans constantly berated the Democrats for the partisanship, and I'm just hoping that being as he does seem to be liked and respected, maybe there won't be as much chance for filibuster. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. Is she living in a dream world, Kate, or not?
I think there's definitely less chance for filibuster this Congress, if only because of the numbers. I mean, I think there's I don't want to discount the amount of goodwill there is going into the Obama administration. As I mentioned earlier, you know, he's been getting praise. He's been getting, you know, good reviews. Praise might be too strong, but good reviews from lawmakers on both sides of the mm-hmm. aisle. But I think that at its core, it's really a numbers game. You know, Democrats are going to be, it's looking now with Al Franken like they'll be 8 seats closer to having 60 votes, which really is the magic number in the Senate. So as a purely numbers game, it's going to be a lot easier for Democrats to block Republican filibusters. The other sort of interesting factor is that they're are a number of moderate Republicans in the Senate that tend to vote with Democrats on, you know, a number of issues. Olympia Snow is one of them from Maine. Arlen Specter, the Pennsylvania Republican, who's pretty moderate, and he's actually in a really tough position because he is up for reelection in 2 years. And so he will probably be inclined to move even more towards the center, which presents its own problems because he may draw a primary challenge. But generally speaking, there are certain Republicans in the Senate that Democrats can kind of target to pick off and bring over to their side. So certainly I think it will be a lot easier for Democrats to overcome, is usually the term, to overcome a Republican filibuster
mm-hmm.
this session.
Thanks, Mary, for your call. Paul is next from Madison. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Hi.
I would love your guest to just talk about, I read on the internet last night that Speaker Pelosi is going to be changing the rules of the House of Representatives in doing away with some of the fairness doctrine that Speaker Gingrich brought in, and it sounds like it's going to be harder for the minority party to function. I guess I'd just like a little detail on that.
Definitely. There was a rules change that was adopted yesterday in the House. And it does a couple of things, and you're right, Paul, when you say that it kind of rolls back, or Democrats would probably take issue with that language, but it does roll back certain changes that were made in 1995 when the Republicans swept to power in the House. And What it does is it one of the things it does is it eliminates Republicans and put in place 6-year term limits for committee chairmen. So it would eliminate that. And then the provision that you referenced is that it makes it harder for the minority party, which in this case is the Republicans, to offer legislation. And then it also rescinds a rule that barred Democrats or barred the majority party for holding votes open with the intent of changing the outcome. You can remember back a few years to the Medicare vote. That vote stayed open for several hours while Republicans did a lot of arm twisting to try to get people to the floor to vote for it. Usually there's a this is all very procedural, but usually there's a set time limit on a vote, but it's up to the majority party that's presiding to bang the gavel. So sometimes a quote-unquote 10-minute vote will stay open for several hours. And the Republicans put in place a rule that would bar that from happening, and the rules package adopted yesterday would rescind that rule. So, you know, potentially allowing votes to be held open, which they de facto are anyway, for longer periods of time. So there definitely are a number of things that strengthen, that were adopted in the rules package that strengthen the power of the majority party, which in this case is the Democrats.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Paul.
No problem.
If there's time for one more question.
Sure, go ahead.
In terms of the appointment of potential Senator Burris, the Illinois governor was indicted for potentially selling that Senate seat for personal gain.
Mm-hmm.
By appointing Senator potential Burris, he's getting potential gain because he's going to be able to go back and say, I was just fooling about selling that. Look, I appointed this fellow who didn't pay me anything. So isn't he indeed profiting from that and making any investigation much more difficult? And if the Senate confirms that, aren't we really helping him and playing into his hand?
I think that it's important to draw the distinction between monetary profit and perhaps political capital profit. I think that the charges against Governor Blagojevich stem mostly from the idea that he was looking to get, you know, monetary profit, that he was actually looking to trade the Senate seat for either a job for him or his family member or, you know, monetary profit, that sort of thing. Certainly, there are political advantages for Governor Blagojevich of appointing someone to the post, but that would be more of a political advantage rather than a monetary one.
But
so I just make that distinction
too, because he's going to be able to say, "Well, I was just fooling. I wasn't considering it. Look who I appointed." So I think that there would be financial benefits in terms of it's going to help his lawsuit.
Mm.
Certainly, that's a good point.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Let's go to Dubuque, Iowa. James, how are things in Dubuque?
Well, we're getting a little bit of snow already, but it's pretty cold here.
Right.
I've been listening to you guys for the last probably 20 minutes or so, and I've been following the whole Burris thing, and I want to say that I think Harry Reid's right in not feeding the potential Senator Burris right away because of the improprieties of Blagojevich. But I think that overall, as long as he's a good candidate and they clear his credentials, I think he'll make a great senator.
Why?
Well, I've looked into his history, and he did great just as a Secretary of State of Illinois. Was that what he was in the past? Or
Attorney General,
I think.
Attorney General,
yeah.
Attorney General. And, I mean, he's got a lot of integrity, from what I understand, and if that can come through into the Senate, that's great.
Kate.
Yeah, I think that there is definitely a contingent of people, even members of the public, certainly, and even, you know, perhaps some lawmakers who are at least privately making the case that Roland Burris should be judged, you know, on the merits of his record and should be separated from the issue involving Governor Blagojevich. However, given the nature of the charges against Blagojevich, I think that that's going to be difficult to do, politically at least.
What a story this is, isn't it? It's just endlessly fascinating.
It is fascinating.
Yeah, it is. Anything else, James?
The other thing I was thinking about, as you guys were mentioning, is Obama has talked about public service and getting the young people involved in public service, and I think it's a great idea. I think we should go back to what happened in the last Depression and start up some great civic works.
Okay.
I mean, maybe send, I mean, kids in their 20s that need, you know, a couple of years, pay off their student loans, send them over to, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, have them help build schools, teach kids, just, you know, basic humanitarian type stuff. just to get him involved and help kickstart, you know, kids to get involved sure. into this is government. Mm-hmm. This is what we do as America.
We're going to talk about this the second hour, Kate, but do you think that anything like this will be announced, a major program?
I would be surprised if there's definitely, it's undeniable that there is a lot of youth excitement over the election of Senator Obama to the presidency. I think that young people, there have been a lot of articles written about the degree to which young people have been engaged in this recent election. I think that the Obama team certainly will try to capitalize on that momentum one way or another in terms of public service. But, you know, I guess it remains to be seen precisely how.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, James, very much for the call. John from Sheboygan, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I think the rules of the Senate now for filibuster are that they just put a word in with the leader, and their filibuster is sanctioned by the leader. And Reid, Senator Reid, denied Senator Dodd's filibuster, and yet it lets the Republicans filibuster all the time. I think they should go back to the old rule where they have to hold the floor, and so bring out the mattresses and make fools of themselves on CNN, you know, talk anti-union or whatever these Democrats from the South want, you know, and just wear them out for a couple days.
Kate.
Well, I think that's actually a point that is the topic of much back and forth between the Republican leadership and the Democratic leadership here in the Senate, and it is John's right when he says that the age of Republicans actually standing on the or I'm sorry, senators actually standing on the floor and filibustering and speaking for hours and hours and reading out of the phone book, that is not what we've been seeing for the most part over the last couple of years. Generally, it works just the way John described, where there's someone who, a Republican usually, who objects to a provision in the bill, and so they'll note their objection. In some cases, they won't take up the bill in that case. Or what'll happen is they'll eventually have a vote, an initial procedural vote, on taking up a piece of legislation. And if Democrats don't get 60 votes, then they won't. Take up the legislation, and so Democrats will say that Republicans filibustered it, but at no point did a Republican actually get up and stand on the floor and talk for hours and hours. So they've kind of come around. The sort of de facto definition of a filibuster has changed on Capitol Hill somewhat.
Thank you for the call. This must be, in the course of modern history, one of the most interesting times to cover Congress and the presidency, isn't it, Kate?
Oh, it's been so interesting, and it's been nonstop with everything developing between, you know, the campaign. And it was one of the interesting aspects of it is that, you know, we had at one point close to 10 members of the Senate that were running for president. And now,
right.
You know, we had two senators facing off in the general election. Now we actually have Senator McCain, who's back in the Senate, Senator Clinton, who's back in the Senate. It will be interesting to see how Senator Clinton is back in the Senate temporarily, but it'll be interesting to see how Senator McCain readjusts to life in the Senate. It'll be interesting to cover. We have two senators, Senator Clinton and Senator Salazar from Colorado, that have been appointed to cabinet posts. So there's a lot of interplay. Joe Biden, the vice president-elect, is a senator.
Mm-hmm.
There's just been a lot of activity through the campaign and in the transition of senators moving into or trying to move into executive branch posts. So that interplay as well has been endlessly fascinating, and you know, the vacancies in Illinois and Minnesota are keeping us busy, and there's just been one story after another. So it'll be interesting to see when everything kind of shakes out and we get to work a little bit more on on reporting on the policy issues as those get rolling.
Right.
It'll be very, 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 very interesting time.
It sure will be. One story after another.
Indeed.
We have about a minute left. Porter from Madison. Hi.
Hi. I don't understand why the Electoral College is still necessary. We now have a highly literate, highly informed population, whereas in 1776 that wasn't the case. And I think it should be one person, one vote, not one person, one vote. I don't see how our votes even matter, because there's the Electoral College that actually makes the decision.
Kate?
Well, I think that that sentiment is definitely one that many Americans support. I think that the reality is that that's constitutionally that's the way the presidential elections are handled, and that in order to change that, it's sort of the inertia of the Senate and the House and government in general. It takes a lot of effort and a lot of agreement to change something like that. So I think that while those sentiments are certainly echoed throughout the country, there is not a lot of realistic probability of changing it anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much. We've been talking about that since everybody has that for a high school debate topic, right?
Exactly.
They have for years and years and years. Kate, thank you so much for being with us. Please join us again as the year goes on and have a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Good. Kate Hunter, our guest this hour, she's a reporter for Congressional Quarterly. And if you go online, you'll be able to retrieve many of the articles that she's written about the economic recovery bill, about Burris and Franken and, well, all kinds of things, the Senate leader, the House leader, etc. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee and our new building, Royce Federal Plaza. And thanks, everybody, for your calls. We have news coming up in just a moment from National Public Radio, and then we will continue and talk about this national service idea. I'm sure you'll have a lot of thoughts about that, so join us for that conversation coming up following the news. It's a minute before 10 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.